Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 418, titled Fireside Chat. This is being recorded on July 28th of 2003. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DAVEEMO. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DAVEEMORY. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL that is linked not only to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website, but also to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Spitfire is a CD and tape duplication service that stocks the various programs I've done over the years. You can reach them at by snail mail, so to speak, at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. And you can reach them by email at Spitfire, or mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are detailed descriptions and annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs. I'm a little behind in the writing, but we'll be caught up within a few weeks or so. And again, the download-only website and the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website are linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Now, this broadcast, again titled Fireside Chat, is going to be something a little bit different, as Monty Python would have said. It may bomb, but we'll see. What I'm going to attempt to do is to tie together, from a theoretical and philosophical standpoint, not only some points of information and to give people an overview of what has gone on over the decades, but I'm also going to make a few suggestions about what I think people should do, and even go into a few of my own personal philosophical views on sort of the meaning of existence, consciousness, etc. This should not be misunderstood as constituting some sort of New Agey type thing, but I do think a lot of people, particularly in these tough times, could perhaps benefit from some of these insights and some of the motivation that might derive from them. Now, we're going to begin by repeating a passage from Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese military philosopher, in his book, The Art of War, one of the classics of military theory, required reading for all general staff officers. And this particular passage, by the way, was quoted in the memoirs of General Reinhard Gehlen. The full title of that book is The Service, The Memoirs of General Reinhard Gehlen. There is a passage by Sun Tzu from his Art of War about psychological warfare. It's not defined as such, but this is what psychological warfare is. And in terms of thinking about the conception of the Underground Reich, or the reality of the Underground Reich, a virtual state that does not have formal geographical borders, literally a Third Reich that went underground at the end of World War II and utilized tremendous economic power, and the strategic placement of many of its operatives within the intelligence services of various countries, including the U.S., and this virtual state that is the Underground Reich is present in many different societies and is present in many different subcultures of our own as well as other societies. Now, in terms of understanding what it is that the Underground Reich is doing, in my estimation, consider this passage from Sun Tzu. Consider also that this passage was quoted in the book The Memoirs of General Reinhard Gehlen. This passage reads, "There is no art higher than that of destroying the enemy's resistance without a fight on the battlefield. The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory. subvert anything of value in the enemy's country, implicate the emissaries of the major powers in criminal undertakings, undermine their position, and destroy their reputation in other ways as well, and expose them to the public ridicule of their fellow citizens. Do not shun the aid of even the lowest and most despicable people. Disrupt the work of their government with every means you can. Spread disunity and dispute among the citizens of the enemy's country. Turn the young against the old. Use every means to destroy their arms, their supplies, and the discipline of the enemy's forces. Debase old traditions and accepted gods. Be generous with promises and rewards to purchase intelligence and accomplices. Send out your secret agents in all directions. Do not skimp with money or with promises, for they yield a high return. Unquote. Well, if one could sum up psychological warfare in just a few sentences, that would be it. And if one thinks about what is taking place in the United States today, imagine the Underground Reich applying just this philosophy. Imagine, too, or bear in mind that the fact that the Underground Reich is a virtual state, a powerful state, a wealthy state, a deadly state, a ruthless state, a far-sighted and very deliberate state, a very disciplined state, but again, in the words of University of Texas professor Philip Bobbitt, a virtual state, one without formal geographical boundaries. Think about what's being done in the United States today, and think about what's being done for those of people who are here in California. Think about what's going on right now in California. One of the things to understand about the Underground Reich is the fact that for the Underground Reich, anti-communism, which was its very real entree not only into the American national security establishment, but also one of the major elements that permitted the Underground Reich, and as we'll see in some future broadcasts, the underground Japanese Empire, for indeed, imperial slash fascist Japan also went underground in terms of its institutions, and due to very significant economic and political connections, was in many ways perpetuated into the post-war period. I wanted to stress that the discourse that I'm giving here should not be misunderstood as fellow traveling in any fashion, but rather in terms of analyzing what is taking place, one should understand that for the United States, for its powerful industrialists and financiers, for many of the people in the military and the intelligence community, and for associated elements within the political establishment and the media establishment, anti-communism was not only an end in and of itself, but could, to a certain extent, have almost been conceptualized as a religious viewpoint, certainly a philosophical viewpoint. Yet for the Underground Reich, anti-communism was only a tactic. At the same time as the Underground Reich was allying itself with not only the American power elite, but also those of other countries, it also, as we know now due to the works of Martin A. Lee and his book, The Beast Reawakens, and Kevin Coogan and his book, The Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, very significant elements of the Underground Reich were also aligning themselves with the Soviet Union and other communist nations, including Cuba and the People's Republic of China. This was not done because they were communist or socialist, but rather, again, consider Sun Tzu here, turning elements of a united force or a united society back against one another. For the United States, anti-communism was a goal in and of itself and a religion. And although the Nazis were anti-communist, they were also fiercely anti-American and anti-democratic. And they were willing to utilize not only elements of the former Soviet Union, but also communist China and Cuba in order to basically weaken the United States economically and I suspect also politically. It's important to understand that for the Underground Reich, ideological affiliations as we understand them were merely a relatively temporary form of political alliance. They were willing to associate themselves with the left, even the far left, in order to undermine the United States, which ultimately the Underground Reich and also the Underground Japanese Empire viewed as the major obstacle to their goal of world domination. The fact of the matter is, too, that there were alliances that the Underground Reich formed with ethnic groups and religious groups with which they actually had serious issue. There are the most profound connections between the Third Reich in both its above ground and underground forms with the Catholic Church, for example, yet the Nazis are fiercely anti-Catholic in terms of philosophy, as we've seen in our discussions of September 11th and related topics. There were very strong connections between the Third Reich and the Underground Reich and Islamic elements, at least a portion of which I think could be accurately termed Islamo-fascist, but some of which would be more properly termed Islamist in that they had a distinct agenda from that of fascism. The point being here that in terms of what has happened in the United States is that, as I emphasized at considerable length in RFA 37, how the United States lost the Second World War, the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, Hitler's intelligence outfit for the Eastern Front in World War II, which in turn was a repository for very powerful elements of the SS, and which in turn became ultimately the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately the German intelligence service, the BND. This was an organization which, as we saw in RFA 37, and also in For the Record 180, was basically an embodiment of the Third Reich's national security establishment. Even while in a POW camp, Major General Reinhard Gehlen, when working for the fledgling American intelligence apparat, was clearing his actions with not only Admiral von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as head of the German state, but also with General Franz Halder, who had been his chief of staff, indicating that the German chain of command was still in operation even when the Gehlen organization was working for the United States. It could be compared very, very accurately, I think, to the concept of the Trojan horse. And we also have seen in RFA 37 and other programs how the Gehlen organization deliberately inflated the threat presented by the Soviet Union. This should in no way be misunderstood as an endorsement for Stalin. But at the same time, the notion that the Soviet Union was going to invade Western Europe, particularly in the post-war period, simply was not tenable in terms of Soviet military capabilities, Soviet logistical capabilities, or Soviet intent. They simply did not have the capability to do that. Plus, with the advent of the nuclear age, any broad frontal warfare in the continent of Europe would have resulted, at the very least, in the almost instantaneous annihilation of the respective armies due to the advent of tactical nuclear weapons, even if intercontinental bombers and missiles had not been used. The point being that the Cold War for the Underground Reich was a way of not only destroying first the Soviet Union, but ultimately weakening, bankrupting, and I suspect ultimately destroying the United States as well. In this context, we should remember, in addition to Sun Tzu, and again, imagine that this concept, this philosophy here, was being applied to the United States, not only spreading disunity and dispute among citizens, but debasing its leaders and creating divisions of all kinds, not only the young against the old, the white against the black, the military against the civilian sector, the North against the South, the East against the West, the rich against the poor, and the left against the right within the United States, even more than they would naturally have been inclined to do. I think it's important to understand in terms of the Underground Reich that in addition to forming ideological alliances which were merely a tactical consideration and in many cases a temporary or flexible one, so too many of the partisan political alliances as well are tactical and if need be temporary and flexible. Although certainly the Underground Reich, as we've seen in so many programs, has the most profound connections to the Bush administration, by the same token, ultimately debasing Bush, destroying the American people's belief in their own political system, and weakening the United States diplomatically, which has certainly taken place in this administration, weakening it economically, which has certainly taken place, weakening the United Kingdom, weakening Tony Blair, doing the same thing in the United Kingdom that is taking place here, turning people against one another, turning regions against one another, weakening it economically, and ultimately destroying the faith of their citizens in their leaders. This is not to be misunderstood as implying the necessity for blind faith in any leadership. On the contrary, I think we need to be knowledgeable and very discriminating in terms of the way we evaluate our political leadership, but at the same time, we also have to be broad-minded. So in terms of trying to explain what is going on, remember this passage from Sun Tzu. I'm going to repeat it very quickly. There is no art higher than that of destroying the enemy's resistance without a fight on the battlefield. This next passage is critical. The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory. Subvert anything of value in the enemy's country. Implicate the emissaries of the major powers in criminal undertakings. Undermine their position and destroy their reputation in other ways as well, and expose them to the public ridicule of their fellow citizens. Do not shun the aid of even the lowest and most despicable people. Disrupt the work of their government with every means you can. Spread disunity and dispute among the citizens of the enemy's country. Turn the young against the old. Use every means to destroy their arms, their supplies, and the discipline of the enemy's forces. Debase old traditions and accepted gods. Be generous with promises and rewards to purchase intelligence and accomplices. Send out your secret agents in all directions. Do not skimp with money or with promises, for they yield a high return. And again, the sowing of division between right and left, old and young, white and black, male and female, gay and straight, Christian and Muslim, Catholic and Protestant, Christian and Jew, Muslim and Jew. The more division, the better. And even after allying oneself with, say, the Bush administration and manipulating it economically, then undermine it, debase him, prepare the way for the man on the white horse, or at the very least, weaken the unity of the United States, which should never be a blind unity, and prepare the way for the subversion and ultimate destruction or subjugation of that society. I think it's also important in this context to understand the von Clausewitz concept of war being the continuation of politics by other means. Also understanding that, as we looked at in For the Record 366, the German power elite has for hundreds of years, or for well over a century, grown up with von Clausewitz, and they understand that the reverse is true, that politics is the continuation of war by other means. And by the same token, absolutely essential in the concept of war is the concept of a post-war, which must necessarily, according to the ideas of von Clausewitz, be viewed as a continuation of the war. And in that context, bearing in mind the Galen organization, bearing in mind the Crusade for Freedom, in which many of these characters were imported into the United States, installed as leaders in our Eastern European ethnic communities, and ultimately incarnated as a powerful and ongoing element of the Republican Party, with Islamist and Islamo-fascist elements incorporated into the Republican ethnic outreach organization in the 80s. Those elements now... Actually, in the 90s, perhaps in the 80s, those elements now linked by the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids to the milieu of Al-Qaeda and the overlapping milieu, plural, of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, and Al-Taqwa. But bear in mind the concept of von Clausewitz and war being the continuation of politics by other means, and politics being the continuation of war by other means, the concept of a post-war as a direct extension of war, and again repeating one sentence from the Sun Tzu passage, in turn quoted from Galen, "The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory." And understanding the nature of the underground Reich, that it works with right and left, depending on what is necessary, that it's political partisanship as well is simply a tactic and flexible and mutable under the circumstances. Bear this in mind. Bear in mind Sun Tzu. Bear in mind von Clausewitz. And also bear in mind another conspiracy theorist, Niccolò Machiavelli, who wrote a book called The Prince hundreds of years ago. That book is standard reading for power politicians and general staff officers. And I won't take the time to go into Machiavelli here, but one should definitely consider Machiavelli. For those people who don't believe in conspiracy theories, and this is not to say that there are not a lot of really whacked things that are around, not to mention fascist things, and that tendency has been growing. But read Sun Tzu, read Sun Tzu's The Art of War, read Karl von Clausewitz's text on war, and read The Prince by Niccolò Machiavelli. And you will see that the concept of conspiracy theory is inextricably linked with the exercise of not only military tactics, but also power political tactics as well. Another passage to consider here, and again in the light of Sun Tzu, von Clausewitz, and Machiavelli, and this is a passage that I read last week. It's from James Stuart Martin's book, All Honorable Men, published in 1950. Martin was the principal investigator into the German-American industrial connections, the Bush family having been an important part of those, and the Thyssen-Bornemisza organization having been a key element of the post-war underground Reich and the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. James Stuart Martin concluded his text with this passage after discussing his experiences in attempting to unsuccessfully to interdict the German-American industrial connections. "The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, they could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity," unquote. "The men who would do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men," unquote. One of the points that I want to make here is that I think an important element of understanding, one that's simply due to the limitations of time and space, that I have not made, is that I don't believe, frankly, that, although I should say that it, certainly there are industrial and financial elements in this country that are perfectly willing to endorse a fascist political system. The coup attempt of 1934 is proof of that. That discussed, by the way, at considerable length in RFA 10, available from Spitfire. Perhaps we'll reprise some of that in a future broadcast. And this is not to say, too, that powerful German industrialists and financiers did not support Hitler. Of course, they did. But at the same time, I think it's very important to understand that, bearing in mind Sun Tzu, bearing in mind von Clausewitz and Machiavelli, that one of the things that I believe has been successfully executed by the Nazis, both in Germany in the period between the World Wars, and to an even greater extent here in the United States in the post-war period, is a very cynical, very strategic, and very deliberate manipulation of the economic and political and psychological environments in such a way as to ultimately prod industrial and financial elements and other political elements related to them into accepting National Socialism or Nazism, whereas they might have had serious reservations or in some cases have been seriously opposed to that. I do not believe that the primary elements in this country, at least in the much of the Cold War period, actually intended to have a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe. But I will go to the mat with anyone to debate and to espouse my view that, in fact, the Underground Reich has deliberately aimed at producing a political catastrophe and an economic catastrophe, which in turn would prod some of the more powerful and wealthy to make a calm judgment of business necessity to impose a fascist totalitarian system in the United States and elsewhere. Some of the most powerful German industrialists and financiers, who actually had reservations about Hitler, ultimately found that they had created a Frankenstein's monster that they could not control. I would recommend in that regard the book The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borken. There was no interest more involved with Hitler than the powerful I.G. Farben chemical cartel. They were inextricably linked with the Bormann organization, yet there were sharp divisions between powerful members of the IG who went along with Hitler, who became war criminals in their own right and major war criminals. Yet, after they had gone along with Hitler and promoted Hitler, many of the people in the IG found that they themselves were subject to the monster that they had created, that Hitler and the Nazi Party to a certain extent became a golem which was able to control its own master through the use of brute force and deadly violence, deadly force and violence where necessary. This is something to keep in mind. We're going to go into some more of the economic history and philosophical history, and against my better judgment, I'm actually going to go into what I would consider to be some spiritual slash philosophical concepts. We may not have time to do this, but what the heck? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Before we conclude this side of For the Record 418, let me remind you that WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs in real audio. Recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at at a longer URL, linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and also to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Spitfire is at spitfirelist.com. They have all of the programs and lectures that I've done over the years available. And the For the Record series is all online. And in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are detailed, annotated, and in many instances, article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs. As I'm speaking on July 28th of 2003, I'm a few weeks behind on the descriptions, but I will get caught up. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 418, Fireside Chat, being recorded on July 28th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.